This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Tanya Olson will tell you that if you're 8 years old, you can be anything. A tiger, a man, a woman, a sea monster, superhero, anything. She likes to explore this little window in life when we aren't clearly defined by the markers that may lock us in later on. That's what Tanya Olson has done in her first book of poems, Boyishly. Tanya Olson's a poet and English professor at Vance Granville Community College and joins us today on The State of Things. Welcome. So good to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tell us a little bit about this. You write about this. The title poem, Boyishly, I think sets up one of the themes that you're trying to that you work through here. Tell us about that.
Well, it's a poem that really is kind of set in pre-adolescence in a summer. You know, and summer is that great in-between time when, you know, you're not yet anything. You're not a student. You're not, you know, you're kind of free. And that's such a great time. I think kids that age are so interesting because they still are willing to see things they've been told not to see and talk about things they've been told not to talk about and believe things that they know they're not supposed to believe. And they don't feel any pull or tension or shame of that yet. So I think that poem is really about the beginning of that, you know, when you start to know you're not supposed to hear certain things or see certain things.
It's a great season because it is a season, but because of the way we've kind of structured things here, you're right, it's an in-between time where we have the most amount of light. So
yeah.
If you're 8 years old and told not to, you have the best chance ever of finding precisely what it is you're not supposed to see. Well, maybe let me ask you to read Boyishly for us.
Absolutely. Boyishly. That summer, the summer I was prevented. Each morning that summer, my eyes matted shut. Sleep, my mother called what joined them. Warm water and a washcloth before I could see. So much water that summer and then the sun. That summer the fruit ripened rapidly. The drone that summer, a boyish summer. The summer I took the boyish waters. Like being drowned that summer. That summer I practiced pulling my t-shirt on like a boy. Two arms, neck, not a girl, neck, two arms. That summer my mother warned, you're getting too big to jump down the stairs like that. All summer I wore orange plaid tough skins and my show-me state shirt. Each day that summer I ate French toast for breakfast. Every noon that summer, a hot dog for lunch. That summer I knocked myself out jumping down the stairs and woke thinking, she cannot find me here like this. That summer I watched our Great Dane get opened up by a bean truck. I never even saw her, mourn the driver. Then she was just there. The summer my already dead grandmother came to visit only me. I saw a wolf lope through the corn each dusk that summer. That summer I threw rocks to make murders of crows rise from the field. The summer I fell in love with their flocking, fell in love with their love. After rain that summer, tiger shadows gathered in the waterway. Everything circled that summer, everything promising, you may come join us whenever you like. That summer I read Folded in the apple tree. That whole summer watched on high. All that sun that summer and then the rain. The fruit ripened rapidly. It seemed the summer that summer was never done.
Tanya Olson reading from her first volume of published poetry, Boyishly. It's wonderful, the repetition of that summer, because for those of us, all of us who remember summertime, right? Summer is this vague, wonderful period of freedom. But then there's that summer. It is a particular summer, and the one which you signal here, there are warnings. There are warnings of the limits to come when you're warned that you're getting too big for that.
Yeah, that shift is coming on, you know. You're about to be limited. You're about to be shaped. You're about to be told, you know, the ways to do things.
These liminal periods are great stuff for poets, especially good poets like you who can actually explore these wonderful moments when we're in between and becoming. We're growing into who we will be.
Yeah, those are exciting moments. And I guess to me, those are the things. I mean, I think poetry to me is it's a place of a lot of promise. You know, you sort of have to, at least this book is an opportunity to kind of remind people of those moments, you know, when you were becoming, you know, becoming is a good word for that. And I think that those are, I don't know, we're not really comfortable with those times. People don't spend a lot of time stressing that, you know, these times of transition are really great. You should spend more time with them. Mm. You know, mostly we spend a lot of time trying to get out of them.
Well, and you teach writing and you teach poetry as well. So it's a good time to talk about just that, what poetry and art in general, but poetry in particular, can do for us by giving us a way into these very difficult topics that are hard to define. But if we can use a kind of infinite form like poetry, it can open us to these possibilities.
Absolutely. I think, to me, I really believe poetry has real work to do in the world day to day. And part of that work is to go and see the things we're not supposed to see, you know, hear the things we're not supposed to hear, and come back and report about that. I mean, I think that's the job for a lot of artists. But to me, poetry is, I don't know, it has a special angle on that.
Will you read another one for us? I'd like
Absolutely.
You to read Take, Save, Go, and then we can talk about that, because in that poem, I think you're exploring a little different theme, and I do want to talk with you about that. I don't know if you think it's better. You can either set it up or go ahead and read it. We'll talk about it afterward, whatever you think is best.
I think I'll read it, and then maybe we can talk about it afterward.
Sounds good.
Take, Save, Go. My mother likes to go for groceries alone, but my dad is restoring an auto and would like to be left on his own, so this Saturday we tag along. My sister is only a few months old and is sleeping still when we return, but I am big enough to recall a street full of screaming fire engines and ambulances. In the other world of night, when I get up to help with my sister, a promise made upon the announcement of her arrival, my mother says she knew to bring the baby yesterday because a voice had told her so. Something soft whispered, leaving an imprint of take, save, go. Cross with impatience, my father had been inside at the kitchen table instead of changing the oil on the street when a woman weaved through the trees in the park, cut catty corner full speed ahead, destroyed the Jeep, and jumped the curb into our house. The front of the car came to rest on my sister's crib, and the woman's purse ended up on my bed. She had been dead before she entered the golf course, and only in the morning's paper does my mother learn this woman was her mother's neighbor, who had driven 75 miles to suffer a stroke, but weaved safely through a labyrinth of trees to discover her next-door neighbor's grandchild's crib at the heart of the maze. A day that began with coffee and country on the radio came to a halt on a floor, voices shouting aloud to stay on the edges, crossing the middle only find you the minotaur, half man, half bull, kept in the center by his father in shame and fury, who, it turns out, is someone you almost knew.
Tanya Olson, the poem is Take, Save, Go from her volume Boyishly. You are doing some readings coming up. Tell us where you're going to read.
I have a reading July 11th at Flyleaf as part of their Second Thursday series. And that'll be a sort of more formal launch for the book. We had an informal launch at the Pinhook already.
All right. Well, that's great. This particular poem, this is a true story.
It is a true
Largely.
Story. Yeah, it is a true story that, when I was a child, we had a car that crashed into our house. And, it turned out to be someone that lived in the same town as my grandmother.
And did your mother have some kind of premonition?
She did. I remember her. It wasn't something that she talked about a lot, but she did. I remember her very clearly telling me one time that she knew that she was supposed to take my sister with her when she went to the store, even though that was not normally what she would have done.
That brings us right back around to what we were talking about earlier, the idea of talking about things that we don't feel comfortable talking about.
Yeah. And it's true. Like, this book is sort of full of, you know, sometimes the very practical things that we're told, aren't there? UFOs and Yetis and werewolves and those sorts of things. But also a lot of, I think, of the emotions that we're not supposed to have or the ways that we're not supposed to live.
Your mother talked about those kinds of things frequently to you, now and then to you? Did you have any way of knowing?
I would say now and then, yeah. You know. Certainly, I think it was something that in some ways it was a place where my mother was sort of really brave, because I don't think she was embarrassed by it, or I don't think she was, felt like it was something that she shouldn't say, but I don't think it was something that she would say to everybody or anybody, you know?
And again, when we take a look at the form of this poem, I think anyone listening to it could follow. There is a kind of narrative style going on, which is to say poetry doesn't need to be obscure. It can be, and if that's the way a writer writes, so be it. But it doesn't need to be obscure to be surprising and to take us to places inside us that we had not explored.
Yeah. I think poetry is I never quite understand why poetry isn't more people's friend, except that poets and poetry do a good job to make sure that that doesn't true, claiming that, you know, poetry has to be hard or poetry is a trick, you know? We're a world that doesn't have a very long generation span, and poems are perfect for working mothers and people on a break, and, you know, I think that, poetry is for the people, you know, and poetry is of the people. So
we're still using language. So in that sense, the technology hasn't changed. Language is something we use to communicate, but the way we're using it is very different. Do poets have to adjust to the technology, in a sense, to a kind of a Twitter universe where words are used in very different ways than they were when Homer was spending 3 days telling us something we already knew?
Sure. And yet I think that good poetry doesn't get too far away from that, you know. There has to be some Homer in your, you know, Twitter-like poetry as well, you know. There has to, you have to be, poetry is a great continuation, you know. If you're a poet, you are of Homer as much as you are of, you know, Twitter and Facebook and everything else.
Well, do you feel that when you write? I mean, to what extent are you conscious of that? The idea that there are some epic and perhaps mythic themes at the center of what your project is about, and yet that's not your audience. They're not going to sit there for 3 days in the hot sun.
Yeah, they're not going to sit there for 3 days in the hot sun, and yet it doesn't take 3 days, you know? We don't have 3 days, and it doesn't take 3 days, you know? You can accomplish – there are a lot of ways to accomplish that, you know? And I do think that that's the thing that I love about poetry is its grandness, you know? Nobody writes like Walt Whitman anymore, but I think that that's kind of, you know, what poetry does. Walt Whitman is American poetry, you know?
And we'll talk a little bit about that and education, because sometimes that's where we stop learning about poetry. If we didn't happen to like Walt Whitman in third grade, we may think, oh, I hate poetry from that day forward and never be allowed to see the full breadth and depth of poetry.
Yeah, I think this is, to me, one place where poetry and poets make a lot of their own problems. I teach at Vance Granville Community College, which is in a small town, in a rural town, in a really, you know, agricultural, industrial era of the state. And yet so many of my students, when they find out I'm a poet or if they see something on my door about poetry, tell me they're a writer too or they're a poet too. So poetry is out there and alive and well and living. And I think poets and poetry spend a lot of time trying to wall it off, you know, keep it to themselves or to say, you're not the right kind of poet or you can't read this poem because it's too difficult. And to me, poetry is the most, you know, democratic form there is, you know. Everybody writes poems. Third graders write poems, but then we make them read terrible, awful poems and tell them it's a trick they have to decode.
That's,
you know?
Right. And if they didn't do it, they're not good enough to be in the class.
Yeah.
Can I get you to read another one for us? How
Absolutely.
About Caught in a Trap?
Yeah. Oops, let me flip to that page.
I think it's page 82 in my volume.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Caught in a Trap, The Dead Redux. There are gully washers in Memphis, and in an upstairs window of Graceland, she is facing the meditation garden as if listening to a distant music, when Lisa Marie finally turns to me and says, "Sweetie, if you can't get on board with Scientology, this thing between us, it's through." Later that night, we are lying yin-yang, head to toe, in the king-size bed when I remind her it wasn't what we thought that brought us together in that NASCAR bar. She had liked me and my hair like her daddy's, the front with a curl, the back closely shorn, that I had played Thin Lizzy's Rosalie on the jukebox. You see, she always dates the Danger Boy, just this time a different form. I protest. I cannot comprehend a world created by hydrogen bombs, volcanoes, and Xenu. She insists, darling, I believe in you. You must learn to suspend your disbelief and trust me until all the facts are in. I say, baby, I am sleeping with a straight girl who was once married to Michael Jackson. There is little left but trust in this world. She curls into me, her head on my breast. She ruffles the short hairs of my neck, and to the rhythm of the river shuffling off the eaves sings. She knows music. I know music too, you see. For that evening, while gently lifting the Mississippi and quietly uniting the quick and the dead, rain was general all over Memphis.
Caught in a Trap, The Dead Redux, Tanya Olson from Boyishly, her first volume of poems. She'll be reading July 11th at Flyleaf Books. So now, it doesn't ever do to ask an author about the biographical details, but since that first, the last one had was rooted in truth, did you and Lisa Marie, I'm just saying, I'm jealous.
Before the powers of the Graceland estate come chasing me down, I will formally announce that Lisa Marie and I were never engaged and never have involved in any hanky-panky
I
of
never
any time.
Had sex with that woman.
That's
and you can,
right.
You can point.
It doesn't even matter what your definition of is.
It's a wonderful poem, and it does it's so many levels. And for me, it gets back to this liminality, and especially if you think about a figure like Lisa Marie Presley, her father Elvis, whose androgyny was a big part of his popular success, Michael Jackson, then her husband for a short time. I mean, what a wonderful way to sort of use her, I guess, in a poem to create some of these images. Was that kind of at the source of this for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I sort of love Elvis in a way that, you know, like people love Elvis and go to Graceland and make pilgrimages. I love Elvis in that way. But I also love Elvis as this kind of American figure, you know? I mean, where he came from and what happened to him and the way that he did it, you know? I have so much respect for Elvis because He just did what he had to do, and the fame found him, you know? He wasn't on American Idol trying to chase that down, you know? He just did what he had to do. He did his art. And yet, that art did so much important work at that time that it kind of ended up eating him in many ways, you know? And so I do. I think, like, as an American figure, I think he's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, and then as that kind of, like, masculine-feminine figure, he's a really interesting piece of America's relationship to that, you know?
And then there's the Scientology that gets built into all of this.
And then there's the Scientology, which is another, you know, fascinating American liminal story, you know, of the in-betweens.
So did these poems come together all at once? Have you been collecting these poems? Where'd they come from?
I've been collecting these poems for a while. I've been writing for, I guess, probably the last 10 years or so. And so I didn't start out to write a book. I was just writing poems. And then, you know, in the last 3 or 4 years, I started to have some success, get a little traction, get a little notice, and decided maybe it's time to put a book together. So it was a really interesting experience of reading back through everything that I'd written and then trying to figure out what held those poems together.
You are such a great storyteller, and narrative is such an important part of your poems. I have to say that you and my next guest, Daniel Wallace, are the two greatest storytellers I've ever heard of the Monty. Do you prefer poetry to fiction, to story writing?
I do. I really think as a poet, even, you know, that's always where a poem starts with me, is a story I want to tell, or, you know, at least a part of a story that I want to investigate. And 99 times out of 100, that's going to come out as a poem instead of a story or a piece of nonfiction.
This is a wonderful collection. Thank you so much for sharing it
with us.
Thank
you. Thank you very much for having me.
Tanya Olson, poet and English professor at Vance Granville Community College. She's going to be doing a reading July 11th at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. After the break, Daniel Wallace joins us to talk about his latest book, The King and Queens of Rome. Stay tuned.